Here we are again. Brighton, old ocean's bauble, multifaceted and scintillating, the jewel of the South Coast. This is my old stomping ground, where I started performing professionally as an outdoor or alfresco entertainer over 30 years ago. I'm here to spend the day by the sea for this special programme, 4 Extra at the British Seaside.
For the next 3 hours, I'll be sharing some remarkable recordings from the BBC's Sound Archive, which not only celebrate our deep love of the seaside, its sense of fun and adventure, but its wider world of pleasure, experiences, and timeless entertainment. Along the way, I'll be joined by several guests who'll be sharing some of their personal seaside memories, visiting a fish and chip shop to learn more about entertainer Max Miller, and discovering how a Brighton beach hut owned by Laurence Olivier inspired the setting for a radio drama. But it's the heady mix of romance and gaiety of the physical environment combined with the wide-ranging variety of entertainment that creates a heady concoction of fun and excitement, particularly in Brighton.
There's nowhere else like it. Nowhere else like it at all. It's got everything. It's got a slightly continental flavour. It's got every kind of person and amenity. It's got a marina, it's got theatres, it's got bookshops, it's got museums, it's got lovely architecture, fascinating. It's got the Sussex Downs, and it's got a marvellous mixture of good taste and vulgarity. It's got one of the most beautiful vulgar buildings in the world, and it caters for all pleasures, and it's dedicated to joy. And I think this is smart.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me.
Ultimately, it's the sea which gives Brighton and all other seaside resorts their meaning. A liminal boundary of tides and behaviours. The sea draws crowds ineluctably towards it like some mass human seasonal migration, a great tide of humanity, which on a sunny summer's day like today teems down Queen's Road from the station towards the sea, just as the trippers have done here in Brighton since the 1860s. Brighton's come a long way from the tiny fishing village that Daniel Defoe wrote about in the 18th century, describing it as a poor fishing town, old built on the edge of the sea. But it's thanks to Prinny, the Prince Regent, later George IV, who loved the city so much that he had the Brighton Pavilion built as his seaside home. This turned Brighthelmstone, as it was then known, into the most fashionable of destinations and resulted in the exotic and hugely popular seaside resort it is today. I first came to Brighton as an undergraduate student in 1979. And as part of my coursework, I studied popular entertainment forms, including the seaside, and discovered all about Pierrot troupes and how they'd been founded in 1891 by Clifford Essex. But there was hardly any written information about them, so rather than research, I decided to do it. I bought a banjo with my 21st birthday money, 20 yards of white satin and some black cotton from a fabric shop in North Lane in order to make the traditional white costumes and black pom-poms worn by the Pierrot characters, and spent my evenings with a sewing machine borrowed from my mother.
One, two, three! By
the sea. It was the heady days of punk rock and the new stand-up comedy circuit. Covent Garden had just started to showcase buskers, and I rather liked the idea of performing to scantily clad girls on Brighton Beach. So I gathered 4 of my friends, learnt a set of 6 songs, and with a lot of gall and chutzpah, we went out and performed on the pebbles. We were called the Pier Rotters, in honour of the rotting West Pier, which we all revered, and which I saw every day from my rented rooftop flat in Regency Square. We made £10.50 on our first day, and spent it all on beer. The Pier Rotters are the last remaining professional Pierrot troupe in the country,
And from our busking origins, we've performed in countless seaside resorts, festivals, pubs, clubs, and even more pubs.
I ask you very confidentially, hey, Gina,
and I've even met Her Royal Highness Queen Elizabeth II at Buckingham Palace in my persona as the Reverend Uncle Tackle. Here's an extract taken from a programme we made as a feature for Kaleidoscope on Radio 4, first broadcast in 1995.
There have been people working the seafronts of Britain since mid-Victorian times when the British seaside took off. And it, at one point there would be, certainly towards the beginning of this century, up until actually really until the Second World War, there were Piro troops on every single beach in the country, really. Every seaside resort would have its own troop. That tradition very much died during the Second World War, mainly because all these troops got enlisted and became ENSA.
I hear your voice and see.
Our day normally starts at about 11 o'clock, having had breakfast, hopefully, most of the time. And then we will convene in our dressing room, shed, caravan, corner of a hall, wherever it is we're happening to make up that day.
I hate this stuff. Really dries your skin out. Yeah, when you got greasy skin.
I haven't.
I got dry skin.
Well, I was familiar with the outfit, which the traditional Piero outfit from the Commedia dell'arte is a white, usually satin, shiny material all over with black pom-poms and a white conical hat with pom-poms on as well. But, yeah, in terms of the costume, I mean, I was sort of prepared for the costume because I knew roughly what it involved, and I've always liked dressing up in ludicrous things anyway.
We will then proceed to put on our makeup, which takes about an hour. The characters tend to take over towards the end of that making up period. It's good that it's an hour, and it's good that you're changing your face and your attitude and your character as the slap goes on.
I think the characterisation in any troupe of performers evolves over time, and obviously draws very heavily on the people who are behind the mask, if you like.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. We are the 1, 2, 3...
The Pier Rotters!
And that is featuring...
Mr. Macko, Mayor of Planet Funny.
Yes, and I, Sir Squacko, the Prince of Porridge.
I am Dirty Dr. Dacko, and it's so nice to meet you all, you lovely people.
And of course, myself, the Reverend Uncle Tacko.
Hello there, everyone. Hello, folks. How much?
And the moment we go through that door, we're in character. We go through making loads of noise, being silly, saying, good afternoon, sir, how are you? Making loads of noise, squeaking the horns, whatever. For the first 5 minutes or so, we just all rant at everyone continuously. So there's just this noisy bunch of clowns, heroes, wandering along. And that draws attention to us and gives us a sense of purpose of having sort of made a distinct break between being ourselves and being the Pier Otters. We're called the Pier Rotters after the rotting West Pier, and that is partly to evoke that sense of nostalgia. A classic mournful image of Brighton, I think, is the fact that the West Pier has been falling into the sea for the last 30 years, and that captures the poignancy of the seaside in days gone by. And in Brighton you've got the sort of the counteracting thing of the Palace Pier, which is a big, commercial, successful pier working in a very 90s fashion, obviously, and you've got the West Pier is like a moment frozen in time, 30 years ago, of how piers were and what point seaside entertainment had reached.
I'll tell you an old-fashioned story. What Uncle used to relate of the Rotters and West Pier in Brighton and how it got in such a state. You've heard of the West Pier in Brighton and how it rots out in the sea. So gather around and I'll tell you the tale as Uncle related to me. Go on, Uncle.
I think any group of people that trust and love one another will always have a degree of tension and friction. I think that's healthy in that you're constantly honing yourself and aware of your relationship with the others. In many ways we do live on an edge. We don't know what's going to happen next. We don't know where we're going to be or who we're going to meet or what's going to happen. It's new and it's fresh every single time, and sometimes it goes horribly wrong.
Yeah, on occasions it has turned quite nasty. I remember we got stoned in Worthing, and That's nothing to do with the use of any recreational drugs. It was, we were walking along the beach in Worthing, and some lads decided it'd be highly amusing to lob rocks at us, so they did. So we went away.
Situations are easy to defuse if you know how, and that comes with experience, and it also comes with a strength knowing that you've got four other blokes behind you.
Often when we're walking along, we will come across an old deer, and he'll be sat there having a butties in a bandstand or wherever on the seafront on a bench. And she remembers Pierrots of old, and she seems to think that we're them. So we'll walk past and she'll say, I haven't seen you boys for ages, where have you been? And it's been 50 years. She doesn't seem to think that, she doesn't realise that we're new ones and we're not. We're not Max Miller. Hello, Maxie, she'll say. But at the same time, I mean, we incorporate things that are a lot more contemporary. I mean, we do Bonzo Dog Band numbers, who are a sort of comparable band in as much as they're a sort of satirical yet musical act. But also being things like Monty Python, punk rock, giving people a sense of being up to the minute, making up to the minute jokes, and we've continued that, really.
It goes right back through time. I mean, in that sense, it's very much a folk tradition. And a lot of the songs that we sing are folk songs in the true sense of the word, that they're shared commonly by ordinary people. When we sing I Do Like to Be Beside the Seaside, it's a part of a folk memory, something that everybody connects with. Everybody can sing, from the oldest person in an old folks' home to the youngest kid in the pram. They can all sing that chorus. I think part of the strength of Pierrots is that or the Pierrotters, is that we're not frozen in aspic. We don't try and create a museum piece. We're trying to make something live and breathe now.
It must have been incredible in the old days when the Pierrots came along or the Punchy Judy came along, and for that 20, 30 minutes everybody was together rather than apart. And we do that. That's what we do. We bring people together on the beach who would normally be solo, and create and turn them into a crowd of people, into a community.
Another instance of these special gigs might be we find a child crying with its mother, sitting there having a miserable time. Maybe it's had a cat or a wasp sting, or it's just having a miserable day, feeling a bit sick. And we'll sing it a song, the child smiles and brightens up and starts giggling. And we obviously make the child's day, like we make the people's day, and we call those WIAs, those gigs, which stands for W-I-A-A, what it's all about. That's what we do it for. I don't think we'd carry on doing it, money or no money, were it not for the odd WIA, and we come away thinking that's what we can do that no one else can do.
That was an extract from a feature we made for Kaleidoscope on Radio 4, called The Pierrotters on Tour, broadcast in 1995. I remember one of my favourite WIAs in our early years was when, at the end of the day, we used to leave the Palace Pier in Brighton, where we'd been performing, and walk along the seafront. As we passed the old fishermen who were mending their nets at the end of the day as the sun sank low below the horizon, they'd always ask us for a song, and we'd always give them one, but instead of giving us any money, they used to give us 5 mackerel, which I'd put in our bag, carry back, and we'd grill them for our tea. I'm Tony Liddington, and throughout this programme, I'll be delving into the BBC Sound Archive and unearthing programme gems celebrating Britain's seaside heritage and popular culture. Still to come, memories about Brighton's West Pier, recollections from the late Corin Redgrave about filming on it, and a drama that imagines the meeting between a famous actor, a playwright, and a legendary seaside entertainer. And I'll be visiting a fish and chip shop to discover one of the more flamboyant costumes worn by the entertainer Max Miller. And later on, hearing about plans for a 175-metre-high vertical pier to be built on Brighton's seafront. Capturing people's living memories about the magic of going to the seaside on holiday between the wars formed the basis for a programme called Sand Between the Toes, first broadcast in 1984. Among other forms of seaside entertainment, people recall seeing one of Brighton's most famous Pierrot troupes, Jack Shepherd's Entertainers, who often performed on the beach, just as the Pierrotters did later. The seaside in the 20s, 30s and 40s was a place for adventure with bucket and spade, of exploration into caves, rock pools and coves, where families could relax together, sharing all the fun and excitement that being at the seaside could offer. Sadly, most of the contributors to this programme are no longer with us. But their memories, recorded in this programme, are captured forever and kept in the BBC Sound Archive.
The excitement began to build up about 2 weeks before we went. Mother would say, I'm going to take this and this and this and this with me, so don't wear them now. We used to have a certain pullover or shirts which would be put on one side, which would be used for the holiday.
We present Sand Between the Toes.
Oh, yes, I think that was really almost, not quite the best part, but one of the best parts was the sort of great build-up before your holiday, because in those days nothing was thrown away and everything was packed away from one year to another, and you'd watch the nanny get it out, and then you'd have that glorious smell of the sea, which still appeared to be stuck to what we call the sand shoes. And sometimes, if you were lucky, a grain of sand might come out.
By the sea, by the sea, by the beautiful sea, you and me, oh, how happy we'll be. When each wave comes a-rolling in, we will duck or swim, and we'll float and fall around the water, over and under, and then up for air. I can teach you a trick that'll make people stare. You do as I do, you'll be safe with me beside you by the seaside, by the beautiful sea.
Memories of what it was like to go on a seaside holiday in the 20s and 30s.
But the excitement used to start because we had to be up at the crack of dawn. It was such a long way to go. The nearest to us, I think, was probably Southend. And the furthest we travelled was down to Bognor Regis. And it might have been the moon. For all that I knew, it was such a long way away.
We lived in London. You'd have an ordinary cab to the station, and then you had what used to be called a fly. And even in those days, I never knew why it was called a fly, and I think it would be like a big sort of wagonette, or sometimes a tiny omnibus if you had a lot of... You had a terrible amount of luggage. Great domed trunks. You seemed to take everything with you.
We would be up at about 6:30, getting the sandwiches and everything ready. Mum would have her big bags, and in those days, used to be big oilcloth bags, full up with the lettuce, tomatoes and cucumbers and the bread and the cheese, ready for us to take down. And you'd all be standing there waiting, and all of a sudden, someone would say, the chara's coming, the chara's coming. When you started off, all the men in the coach would have a whip round. They'd take all the halfpennies and pennies out of the pockets. Mums used to dig in their handbags for them, and the old purse used to come out with the occasional moth. And the other kids that couldn't go, and lots of them at school, when I was at school, had got no shoes and socks on their feet. And those that were affluent enough to go used to get all the halfpennies and pennies, and just before the charabang pulled away, all the winds would be wound down, and they used to throw these halfpennies and pennies out into the street, and all the kids used to scramble for them. And the shout that went up was just like football teams coming out at Wembley, isn't it?
Well, there was the excitement of going to generally Victoria station. And I was a person who was very inconvenient because I was always sick one way or the other. And I always had to sit with my face to the engine. And then the windows were opened and then the smuts would come in because, of course, in those days, trains were run by coal. And then, of course, nobody else wanted the windows open because the smuts, but because poor me was always going to be sick, I had to have the window open. I suspect I made the most of it.
But as you got outside of London, as you got from London, you'd go out through Orpington, go down through Dartford. Somebody used to produce the occasional musical instrument. Somebody would get a banjo or a trumpet. Next thing, everybody in the coach would be singing. And you'd see the mums and dads sitting together holding hands. And it was altogether sort of a romantic time for them too, not only for us kids, But everybody enjoyed themselves.
Of course, we were all determined to enjoy ourselves. And I do remember the excitement. Although excitement is marvellous, it was also difficult because I used to get collywobbles in my stomach and I have to sit very, very still. And this would go on for ages until the train began to slow down. And then we'd open the carriage windows and look out and see the great glass roof on Brighton Station. And then I think the excitement stopped. It was something new that moved in. It was just the sheer joy of the holiday. And I was no longer frightened of collapsing inside or crying or anything, which was, I was liable to do. And this was all spent just seeing Brighton Station again. And then getting out onto the platform with the bags and the trunks and, of course, the bucket and spade which we brought with us. And then Father would call for a porter and he'd come up with a lovely sort of wagon thing which everything would go onto. And then we'd trail behind until we got to the ticket barrier. And there always seemed to be so many people and I just couldn't wait to get out and to get down to the sea.
You'd all sort of rush to get out and the first one to glimpse the sea. That was lucky. We had sayings when we were kids, like our two fingers, we used to wet on our tongue and touch our collar and say, you and me to see the sea. And the first one to see the sea and the first one to get in at Queen's Road. It was marvellous.
It was wonderful to arrive at the seaside and smell the sea and see it. It's absolutely beautiful. And the excitement of wondering what sort of place we were staying at, guest house, the hotel, whether it had a view of the sea. 9 times out of 10, it didn't. Couldn't see it.
In the early days, we went to rooms, and mainly because they were cheap. You went to rooms, and your mother did the shopping, and on that occasion it was Mrs. Fletcher, did the cooking. You had 2 bedrooms, one for Mother and myself, and one for Dad and my brother. And Mrs. Fletcher did all the housework. There was no work of that sort to do, and she cooked the food you brought in. And you paid 6 pence a week extra for the cruet. My father said that was scandalous. Otherwise, it was all right. There was no bath, of course. You couldn't have a bath. Nobody had a bath. And as my father said, he always took these things very amiably. Well, we've got the sea. What's the matter with the sea? So there we were.
Yeah, well, of course, then there was always waking up on the first morning when you were there. Because, you know, you weren't in your own bedroom and everything was different. And, I don't know, there was always a stain on the ceiling, which you made into some sort of a map or something or other, you know, in your mind, thinking about it. And then when you got fully awake, I mean, you were waiting then to get out and get down to breakfast and then down to the beach.
You were dying to get down to the beach, but it very much depended on how soon the grown-ups got up and how soon the nanny wanted to get up. And then there was always the packing up of all these sand shoes and your pants. I had these rubber bathing drawers, they were called, in which you put... See, we, being doctor's children, my father was a doctor, and he would never allow us to bathe for at least 2 days, only paddling, because I think he thought you might get cold, you see.
We always went in the water, and... Because it never really crossed our mind, I suppose. We were too young to worry about getting changed down on the beach. And, of course, Mum had a capacious lap and a great big towel. And that was your changing tent. You'd go... Now, of course, the bathing costumes were so funny then, weren't they? You know, nobody ever thought of a bikini. It was sort of a one-piece job with these stripes going across. You looked like Bill the Burglar. If you got even got a black mask on and a pair of trousers, you could have been nicked.
I was always embarrassed having to change on the beach. Not, I think, embarrassed that anybody would see me naked or anything, but frigging about with a towel round my middle and pulling up my bathing dress. And it was a bathing dress then, it wasn't just trunks. And coming out of the water wet and doing this all over again, I hated even more.
You used to go in your knickers those days. We never had bathing suits and that till you got older.
I would be allowed to undress on the beach, heavily covered by Nanny with a towel.
But my mother, of course, couldn't undress on the beach, so she would go into a bathing machine, which had little steps up and a door one side, and little steps out and a door on the other. And then there used to be bathing machine ladies who would push these machines out into the sea.
Actually, Brighton, although it's only a pebble beach, I always used to think that a pebble beach was much better for bathing from, because unlike a sandy beach, when you came out to get dry, you didn't take about 3 hours trying to remove all the particles of sand. Particularly on a clear day with the sun shining, you could dive down and sort of swim along on the bottom of the sea, as it were, and it was remarkably peaceful there, as indeed I suppose it is today.
It took a lot to get us in, and then once we got in, we wouldn't come out. And often Dad had to be sent in to fetch us out.
After we'd been in the sea, because it was supposed you might very easily catch cold, we always give them ginger biscuits, because they were supposed to be more warming than any. I still think of ginger nuts as being something that's going to warm you up. We used to build fantastic sandcastles. Yeah. We always had a bucket and a spade of some sort.
And, of course, you with your mates, four or five of us, we'd dig a great big sandcastle, the biggest thing you could ever get, you know, and we'd make a moat round it, and you'd put turrets on the top, and then you'd run down to the sea and get your bucket of water. Everybody had these old tin buckets. And chuck the water in there, and you'd splash about, and gradually the water would disappear down through the sand. And then, of course, the tide would come in and wash the rotten thing away. You know, you'd made a lovely sandcastle. Or else one of them would get a bit umpty with you over something you've done, and he'd jump on your sandcastle. So, of course, everybody used to go and bomb on his sandcastle, and eventually you've just got 2 minutes. But the other thing you used to see down there was the man, the professional sandcastle maker, and he would do a copy in sand of Windsor Castle or Balmoral, and he'd work on this all the morning, and it would be absolutely beautiful. His sandcastles were like no sandcastles you ever saw in your life. And then he would sit by the side of it with his upturned cap, and people would throw the odd coin into his cap. And that's how he earned his living, just by making every night the tide used to come in and take your sandcastle away.
Oh, yes, everybody used to go on the pier. I used to take season tickets.
My remembrances of the pier is always getting my heel caught in those slats and letting out loud shrieks because I couldn't get it out again.
They used to have a kind of a bingo, but it wasn't called bingo then, it was housey-housey. And they'd have raffles. You'd get on the pier and there'd be a couple of men and they'd have great big bars of chocolate or a box of chocolates or something like that. And for a halfpenny, if you bought a raffle ticket, and you waited for about 20 minutes until they sold all the raffle tickets, they would draw it, and for a halfpenny you could win a £2 box of chocolates.
But the piers really were really meeting places for people. And people used to go there to hear the bands. We used to sit in deck chairs all the way around. You could go inside if you wished, but mostly people sat outside. They were kind of like a bandstand on the pier.
And we even had dancing at the end of the pier, and it was quite good. They had a band, and it was sixpence. And you could go into the bar and have a drink and overlook the dance floor. It was open air, and despite the weather, They still went on the pier to dance.
There were a lot of these machines where you could put in a penny and they'd have the inviting titles at the top, What the Butler Saw, or A Hot Scene in Paris. You put a penny in and watched these cards flap over one by one. It made it look more like moving pictures. I know I had a penny one day and I thought, now, which one shall I put my penny in? So I chose Hot Scene in Paris. Looked to left and right to see that nobody should see me put my penny in such a title. And what it turned out to be was a fire engine dashing through the streets. So I was quite disappointed there.
I didn't really like what the butler saw and all that kind of thing. But I did love going to the end of the pier because the Golden Eagle used to arrive there from Greenwich, I suppose.
Any more of the Golden Eagle? Sails in 5 minutes. 5 minutes. Last chance for the Golden Eagle.
The Golden Eagle, of course, there were others, I imagine, were very highly coloured, perhaps grotesquely painted, I don't remember, but for me, they were beautiful. And they had huge paddles which churred the water, which I liked very much. The noise was good.
We went down all these iron steps, open iron steps, and then the steamers used to come up there from... Where are they? The paddle steamers, weren't they? And they used to go over to Dieppe and to Boulogne, and then also they used to go to... Cowes for Cowes Week. I've done that many a time. Yes, they used to have a quartet that used to scrape away. In fact, I believe there were four men that used to come on for the whole season.
Steamers, when we was kids, and when I grew up into being a youth, we used to take our girlfriends on them on rough nights when we used to have an 18-penny trip up to Beachy Head and back. And we used to take them and we used to do the girls a treat. We used to buy them chocolate and that so as to make them feel bad. It was a dirty trick, but it was good fun.
They used to roll like mad if you got in a rough sea. Oh, it was dreadful. It really was. They rolled like mad. I've seen people sick as hell going up the Solent because they...
Go on, make yourself sick on those toffee apples. They were really lovely. Dark brown sugar, so sweet, tasted just like lovely butterscotch. And for eating, you've got a lovely big toffee. And when you licked all the toffee off, of course, you could eat the apple. That was a meal in itself for Halfpenny.
There was like barrows with tops to them, with sunshade like roofs, and they used to have winkles all done in little bowls and cockles and mussels, and all the holiday makers used to come to have a dish of them. I couldn't eat winkles. Oh.
The epitome, I think, of going on holiday then was for the grown-ups to see my mother having time off from looking after all us to go down, and she used to love her plate of whelks. And in those days, a plate of whelks with the salt and pepper and the brown bread and butter, and it wasn't a thin slice, it was a chunk of bread and quite a big plate full of whelks and cockles. Or else you'd get a halfpenny glass of sarsaparilla, and that had got the most gorgeous flavour. It was in between raspberries and blackcurrants, the flavour. You could have it hot or cold. If it was a cold day, you know, you'd have an halfpenny glass of that. But there were so many things you could buy for a halfpenny then. All kinds of things. And it wasn't dear, and it wasn't what it cost, but it was the fact that you're doing something different that brought the excitement element into it. To go down and see the pieros on the end of the pier, the songs that they were singing, to see the costumes, to see the makeup. But now we're all together.
Jack Shepherd's Entertainers was on a stage that was set up on the beach, and the deck chairs were put round in semicircles facing the stage. There was a man at the piano, Mr. Waterwaller, they called him.
First of all, the company would come on in their Pierrot costumes, which I've always loved, actually.
Yeah, with their tall hats and pom-poms on them. It was more like the old-time musical thing.
Here's a funny thing. I was walking along the prom the other day when I met my mother-in-law.
You don't think that's funny? You haven't met my mother-in-law, I'll tell you.
And I remember particularly at Margate. We were there on the sands watching the concert party when everything had to stop for the very simple reason that Amy Johnson was flying to Australia. And the comedian said, this is Amy Johnson's plane going over now. And we all stopped and looked up and cheered Amy Johnson.
Look, we've got Amy Johnson's plane overhead. It's Amy Johnson on the way to Australia. Give a cheer for Amy, wonderful Amy. It's time for the magic bit. The magic bit is when we turn your money into our money. Now, come on, spare, dig deep for Jack Shepherd's lot. Come on.
And instead of paying an entrance fee, you paid nothing. You didn't pay anything at all. You saw the show, and then they would come round. They would have a sort of a velvet bag, rather like they do in church on a Sunday morning, you know. But for them, it was the way they earned their money.
Because when I started coming round from one place, you moved on to another. Oh, when all them side shows was on the front, you could have a complete day's entertainment. Yeah, they all done the collecting box stunt. Oh, then there was a Punch and Judy the other side of the West Pier. He was an old chap. He was very, very good. He had all the characters here, the crocodile, the policeman, Punch, Judy, dog, the real dog he had.
It's interesting to recall that particularly at holiday times, I think it was the News Chronicle, used to have a very good gimmick to increase their sales. They used to have a bloke walking about the front, or in the vicinity of the front, down West Street and along the front between the piers, and you were supposed to have a copy of the News Chronicle, go up to him and say, you are Mr. Lobby Ludd, I claim the News Chronicle prize, and you get a fiver. Well, there used to be thousands of people milling about, and the special van selling copies of the News Chronicle, which I think used to be a penny at that time. And I bought a paper once, and I was walking down Queen's Road, and I saw this bloke, and I thought, I'm sure that's him, and I must have followed him for 5 miles at least before I plucked up enough courage to challenge him. I said to him, you are Mr. Lobby Ludd, I claim the News Chronicle prize. He said, I'm very sorry, son, it's not me. And that was it, so that's about as near as I've come to winning a fiver, I think.
Repent ye all ye sinners, repent, accept the way of the Lord.
And along the front, there used to be always preaching, saving you. Always going to save you, you know, all these gospel things. And I've been saved. You know, like Billy Graham teaches. Well, there used to be, and then you'd get probably an old lady you'd seen. She'd join them and she'd say, and I've been saved. We should go in there just to hear it.
A wet day at the seaside was purgatory. Absolute purgatory. People would just make... They'd all have their little baskets or their bags with their sandwiches and that. And they'd try to get underneath the pier. And there wasn't a great deal... There wasn't a great deal of shelter. You could go into the amusement arcades. But on a wet day, you wouldn't find... There'd be no amusement on the beach whatsoever. And everybody used to wait to get back on the coach. And, of course, there's no drink drive then. And the old coach driver would probably be in the local pub and having his lunch, which used to be a liquid one. You'd sit in the coach steaming. You'd sit there and see steam coming off the people sitting as they ate their sandwiches. A bedraggled lot, air all over the place. People that have gone down with high expectations and great hopes for a good day. They're all despondent. And once again, until somebody would pull out a mouth organ or something like that, and again, everybody would start to sing. And once they started singing, then all their spirits would rise again.
Oh, you can't trust a special like the old-time coppers when you can't find your way up.
We wrote postcards. Rainy days, you had to write postcards.
I used to spend hours looking at all the saucy postcards, which I think in those days used to be a penny each, and there was always thousands of people around and you and saying, oh, I must get one for Aunt Lillian and one for Auntie Beth and one for Uncle George. You know, they must have sold thousands of them on a good sunny day in Brighton.
Well, you'd send them to the maids in the house at home, and you'd send them to your school friends, I suppose, and perhaps a cousin or two. Less fortunate people. We were always made to send things from all our holidays to people who were less fortunate in London, who hadn't been able to go on a holiday. We were always made to do that.
The very first morning that we arrived at Felpham, certainly, I used to be allowed to go out and buy some postcards, and then I would write those on the sand. And it seemed to me on that first day that the holiday was now something permanent. It would go on forever and ever. But, of course, it didn't. And when the time came at the end and everything had to be packed up and we'd take the clothes out of the drawers and take them down to Mother to pack, and that seemed awful. It was so sad. And we weren't allowed to go on the beach that day because we were in our travelling clothes and we weren't to get grubby or sandy or anything.
When the time came to pack up, I mean, I was always miserable and I wanted to take home everything I could take home. We went and we got all the seaweed that we could, and the stones, lovely stones we'd pick up, which all looked so shiny and beautiful, and shells. Mind you, we made a beautiful shell collection, and I insisted on taking great strings of seaweed.
To go home with your spoils from the seaside, smelling of the sea, clutching these little bags of rock, whether it was pineapple or raspberry, or whether it got Brighton through it, or Southend or sea, or a Kiss Me Quick hat, clutching a bowl of whelks for Uncle Harry. Of course, the time would go so quickly. It was a feeling of despondency sometimes when you went home.
That was Sand Between the Toes.
And then we got into the train, and the sad part was that before the journey was over, the seaweed had lost its lustre, and the stones didn't shine anymore, and we were back again in London.
Technical presentation was by Mo Usher and Nick Russell Pavia. The producer was Peter Hall.
Sand Between the Toes. Sand, yeah, that's what it was, really. Sand Between the Toes. Sand in your sandwiches. Sand in your ears. Sand in your ear. It was a good bath. And to bed.
That was Sand Between the Toes, first broadcast in 1984, capturing the magic of the seaside holiday between the wars. Still to come, a glimpse into the life of legendary entertainer Max Miller, and fond memories of the finest pleasure pier ever to be built, Brighton's West Pier.
I'm making my way now along the beach, just a short way to the Old Ship Hotel. The Old Ship is Brighton's oldest hotel, where the Prince Regent held all his masked balls when the pavilion was being built, and where I entertained as one of the pier otters many years ago.
I'm joined here by Max Tyler, who is a collector of theatrical and seaside ephemera. He's got the most fantastic collection of all sorts of artefacts connected with concert party and Pierrot troupes. So it's lovely to have you here, Max, over a cup of tea.
A pleasure. Nice to be here.
How on earth did you start collecting and why?
Well, it was really in 1945 when the war had finished and seaside shows came back again after a period when most of the entertainers had been entertaining in Ensor and abroad, and they came back again and summer shows started. And I went to the Oval Margate, which was very famous for summer shows, but the Oval Margate was a typical summer show of the smaller ones, which got me interested. And then, of course, afterwards, I got interested in the larger shows, and to my mind, the very nicest one of all was the folderols. The folderols started in 1911 in Scarborough. They were called the folderols because they were in the new floral hall up there, And there was a George Lashwood music hall song called Fol-de-ra-lol, 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 Laddie. And when George used to sing this, he was dressed up in Regency costume. And so the person who started the summer show thought, well, let's give it the name, it'll posh it up a bit and let people know what they're receiving. The material was, we wouldn't like it much now, it was too obvious, but in those days it was enough, and as long as there was a blackout at the end with a final punchline and a music playing the artists off, that was all they wanted.
And how many Fol-de-ra-lol troops were they? Was it one troop that went from resort to resort, or were there many different troops?
Although in the beginning there were just the small shows, which got larger and larger, those small shows carried on right the way through. So you had the large, as I call, almost the company summer shows running in the town, as well as the very small summer shows. It was expensive to set up, and they'd set it up in one seaside resort for the summer. But then they really wanted to use the costumes and the scenery again, but they couldn't come back and use the same thing next year. So what they used to do was look around for another similar resort and ask them if they would like to take a second company over. So the maximum number of Fol-de-ra-lols were four, which was Hastings, Eastbourne, Sandown and Llandudno. And they all had four shows running at the same time with different material. But if you were at Eastbourne one year and you went to Brighton the next year, you sometimes saw more or less the same show. And these summer shows were very, very popular.
Thank you, Max. You've given us a real insight to a form of entertainment, the seaside show, which has all but been lost in recent years. Thanks, Max. It's been a delight.
A pleasure.
There's an extraordinary piece of BBC archive called Round the Fol-de-ra-lols, first broadcast in 1937 on what was then the National Programme.
This is the National Programme, shows from the seaside, a series of concert party broadcasts.
In this particular clip, produced by Gretrix Newman and arranged by Harry S. Pepper, four concert party shows from different resorts hundreds of miles apart are linked together for the first time, a Eurovision Song Contest of its day. But let Harry S. Pepper take up the story.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Harry Pepper here on the side of the stage at Eastbourne. Before we start, I should like to tell everyone that this programme is going to be very, very difficult. Last year, we had the three Fol-de-ra-lol shows. This year, Mr. Newman has saved up a few pennies during the winter and has bought himself another show at Sandown, Isle of Wight. And tonight, we shall include that as well. All four companies take part in this programme and all actually speak to one another. A complete broadcast involves nearly 1,000 miles of landline, 20 microphones, a dramatic control panel and a very big squad of engineers. Myself and Uncle Tom Cobbley and all, and a grand muster of over 68 Fol-de-ra-lols. When the show has started from here, I shall get into a car fitted with radio and drive across to Hastings in time to say goodnight to you from there. So I think we'd better start. Here we are, ladies and gentlemen, Round the Fol-de-ra-lols, number one, Eastbourne.
Old Jim Cole was a merry old soul, was a merry old soul, you bet. He called for his pipe and he called for his bowl and he called for his violet cents. He then tuned in and said with a grin, I'll get some fun, said he. First he listened to the shipping broadcast.
In districts Dogger and Humber, winds north and south with local fog, snow, rain, typhoon, monsoon and pontoon.
The climax to this broadcast is a live radio link-up between the four different Fol's shows in the four different seaside resorts, each show and audience following on from one another in singing the same song verse by verse. It's a truly extraordinary technical achievement when broadcast radio was still in its infancy.
Eastbourne!
Just a song at
twilight when the lights are all
and
the bleak shadows softly come and go.
And did know?
The lobby will ring so
A remarkable piece of broadcasting history there, from the archives of 1937, entitled Round the Folderols, arranged by Harry S. Pepper and produced by Gretrix Newman. I'm Tony Liddington, and I'm here in Brighton for 4 Extra at the British Seaside, featuring shows about the seaside from the BBC Sound Archives. One of the most famous seaside entertainers to come out of the Pierrot concert party tradition, and who was hugely popular in the 50s and 60s, was Max Miller, who was known then as Harry Sargent and who started his career right here in Brighton. He inspired a whole new generation of comedians.
I'm known as the cheeky chappy. The things I say are snappy. That's why the pretty girls all fall for me. I don't do things contrary. My love will never vary. Ask Mary from the dairy. Here's the key. I fell in love with Mary from the dairy.
Max Miller helped to write the rather risque words to the comic song Mary from the Dairy, and he adopted it as his signature tune, which began every one of his stage appearances. Wherever he went, people flocked to see him. Here he is performing in the Metropolitan Music Hall, recorded live in 1957.
Now, as a funny thing, ladies and gentlemen, this is a funny thing. I went down the other night, and I caught the wife in the front room sitting on a white horse in the nude. I said, who are you supposed to be? She said, I'm Lady Godiva. I said, Lady Godiva was a great tipster. She was the greatest tipster. She put all she had on horse. She said, what do you think I'm doing?
The wonderful, indomitable Max Miller. I'm now outside Bardsley's Fish and Chip restaurant on Baker Street in Brighton, where they have a collection of Max Miller memorabilia, including some of his more flamboyant costumes. And here, I'm meeting up with John Henty from the Max Miller Appreciation Society.
Morning.
Hiya.
How are you doing? Okay. Meeting John, you want a Max Miller room? Throw on the right.
Thank you.
Hi, John. Good to meet you.
Yes, hello, Tony. Welcome to the Max Miller Museum. It's in a fish and chip shop. I mean, Victoria and Albert is one thing, fish and chips is another. Look at this suit.
It's fantastic. It's a suit of many colours, certainly.
Yeah, a bit like your shirt, actually. It is definitely one of Max's, probably from the wartime, 1940s, but he was wearing things like that in the 20s and the 30s as well. It's blue, it's garish, it's got flowers all over it. And the point is that the moment he appeared on stage, people said, that's Max Miller.
And he had just this one costume?
Oh, no, I should think he had a whole wardrobe. Actually, there's some ladies in Edward Street here in Brighton, or used to be, and they used to sew all these up for him. Often some original material, but very often from curtains and goodness, anything going. During the war, it would have been curtains, I imagine.
And the other things that we've got in here, a bit further along, we've got some playbills and we've got some record sleeves and programmes.
The Max Miller Appreciation Society, they got all this stuff together over a period of years, and we desperately needed to put it somewhere. I came in to have fish and chips, as you would do in Brighton, of course. And in here, I met Roy, the bloke in charge, the bloke you've just met. And blow me, if there wasn't a little poster on the wall and it said on there, the cheeky chippy, right? I thought, that's unbelievable. I said, Roy, are you the cheeky chippy? He said, yes, I am. And I said, did you ever see Max? Of course I did. And that's how this whole place here came about.
And of course, he didn't live too far away from here, did he?
No. Well, he lived in numerous places, actually. When he became wealthy, he could afford other houses. When he was very poor in the early days, of course, he had to move out of houses rather fast, often out of the back window, because the landlord was at the front. So he moved all over the place, including a rather grand place called Ovingdean, which is in that direction to the east. And there he actually had a splendid mansion, and he let that out during the war to St Dunstan's, the blind, because he had great empathy with blind people.
And although Max became a huge star, it's worth remembering that his early days were kind of quite humble performance origins with Jack Shepherd's.
Totally right, yeah, that's how it all started. He did a bit of service, was in India for a short time, and that's where he very briefly lost his sight and hence his understanding of blind and visually impaired people. But no, he came back to Brighton, and of course seafront entertainment in those days was wonderful, all open air stuff, you know. Jack Shepherd had 2 places, one to the east and one to the west in Hove, and Max used to work both those places, and that's where he met his wife as well, and he used to cycle between both venues and do two or three shows in a day easily. When he met this lady in the concert party, Catherine, she saw a future, if you like, to build on his sort of cheeky image. Chappy, well, that's a nice little term. The two go together very well, cheeky chippy, cheeky chappy. And so he became the cheeky chappy, and that's, of course, how he built his reputation.
And that reputation everybody remembers as being quite near the knuckle. Do you think it verged into the vulgar at all?
Verged into the vulgar. He'd like that. He'd like that. Certainly not. I mean, he used to point at the audience and say, you're the sort of people who get me into trouble. In those days, it was innuendo, right? No, it was never, ever vulgar as such. It was up to you. If you had vulgar thoughts, that's your problem, not Max's.
But my wife, though I talk a lot about my wife, I do really talk a lot about my wife, but really, she's the best wife in the world, I really met. She weighs 20 stone. 20 stone, what I go through.
And as his career progressed, it wasn't just a variety entertainer, but like Norman Wisdom and George Formby, he was a film star as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably not his best media, if you like. Why? Because Max needed to be in front of a live audience with his foot on the old footlights and pointing at people, and especially large ladies in the front audience. Now, come along, dear, you know, now I know what you're thinking. All that stuff. In movies, he had a script, and Max was not a scripted person. That's also why he didn't always come out best on radio, funnily enough. On gramophone record, okay, except that he had to keep the whole act into 3 minutes, unfortunately, so it's all speeded up and you have difficulty hearing what he's saying because he talks so fast, you know, that sort of thing, very, very Brighton. But basically, the best way to see Max Miller was on a stage, obviously, and preferably at the Brighton Hippodrome or the Holborn Empire or all over the country. He toured all over the country.
Did you see him?
I did see him. I saw him at the Croydon Empire.
And what's your memory of that performance?
I think it was really the impact, the moment that the curtains went back and the music struck up, dan da dan da dan da dan da 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 da, and he come on fairly slowly because there was a big build up. And that's what it was, the impact of the bloke, and also that magnetic personality. Max just had that rapport, which is so crucial, with the audience. And that's why, in terms of radio and films, he didn't have that because the audience wasn't there.